I'm Zena.
And I'm Renee.
Welcome to When You Just Want a Glass of Wine, a podcast dedicated to making wine drinking more approachable and inclusive. Join us as we decode the language and unlock the customs of wine drinking. Cheers.
Cheers. Here we go. All right. Welcome to our episode, a deep dive into Long Island wines. Cheers.
Good morning.
Good morning, everybody. I'm here without my partner in wine, Renee, to interview my friend, winemaker, co-owner of Chronicle Wines, and owner of Saltbird Wines, Robin Epperson McCarthy.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
And we also have a special guest here, my mom, Elaine Poland. Hi, Mom.
Hi. Cheers, everyone.
Cheers. Anyhow, before we get into this deep dive of Long Island wines, which I specifically picked because I am from Long Island, and I have been coming here and drinking Saltbird since 2020, I feel like.
About then.
Yeah. What do you have in your glass, and what do I have in my glass today?
You've got the 2023 Stainless Steel Sauvignon Blanc.
The nose on this is beautiful.
I love Sauvignon Blanc, and I also love Merlot, so I've got the 2020 Saltbird Merlot in my glass.
Those are two of my favorite of your wines. We actually have some of your Saltbird Merlot because my partner, he is a Merlot drinker. And when I brought him here a couple years ago, he just loved that Merlot. It's wonderful. And this, the Sauvignon Blanc, the aromas, tropicalness.
Yep.
And you said you were in New Zealand. So let's start talking about how you got where you are today so you can tell a little bit about why this Sauvignon Blanc is just like, so reminiscent of it.
I love hearing how winemakers get into wine because to go to college for wine, you're going to college to make wine before you're even legally able to drink it in this country.
Right.
So most people end up in a roundabout way, like I did. I was actually pre-med biochemistry studying for MCATs.
Oh, wow.
Came home for a summer and was working on the endangered species project out here, counting piping plovers and doing habitat maintenance for them. So I'm a bird nerd, thus the name Saltbird Cellars.
Ah, Saltbird.
Yeah.
Now I get it. There you go.
It all comes together. And I'd taken ornithology classes in college, as you do as a nerd.
Love it.
So I ended up getting a job at Premium Wine Group, which is a contract winery out here where I produce my wines and where most of Chronicle Wines come from, as their lab tech during harvest. And I walked in there in the middle of October, peak harvest, and demanded to talk to whoever was in charge of hiring and firing, and he hired me the next day. And the guy who was running the lab at that time ended up leaving shortly after harvest. And then I was just, at the age of 21, given, like, lab director for this contract facility.
Wow.
And I worked there for 6.5 years. And during that time, my boss was Russell Hearn, who's from Australia. So he'd traveled. Winemakers and cellar hands do this bi-hemisphere thing because when it's winter here, it's summer in the southern hemisphere. So we will swap crews. Mm-hmm. So I ended up working in Australia and New Zealand. I did a couple of long 6-month vintages in New Zealand. So I basically lived there for half a year.
And that's why this is so reminiscent of this, but not as acidic.
No.
I always say the Sauvignon Blanc, I love a Sauvignon Blanc, but sometimes, you know, you drink it and you're like,
yeah.
So this has beautiful acidity.
So Sauvignon Blanc has this very generous ripening window. Mm-hmm. So if you pick it towards the beginning like they do in New Zealand, and New Zealand made this their style intentionally with that high acidity, the green grass. Like in the summertime, if I get even like a whiff of sulfur and green grass, I'm like, New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. And gooseberries,
yes.
You know, and they use cat pee, which you don't see as much anymore. But they made it their style because in Marlborough, they can't pick everything at peak ripeness. There's not enough picking crews or machine harvesters or hours in the day. So they start picking it when it's first ripened, about, you know, 19, 20 bricks, which is our measure of sugar. And that will end up actually, sadly, being what they sweeten up and send to us Americans, slightly sweet for the export market for $12.99 a bottle.
Yep.
And then the best stuff from New Zealand, we don't even see. So you've had my Migratus, which is a barrel fermented Sauvignon Blanc. That is reminiscent of Vavasor's Claudia, which is done in their, what they call the dirty French cellar over there. So they've got the dirty French cellar where they do, and it's it kicks off wild, it's native yeast, it's barrel stirring for months. And then they have a brand new cellar, which is where they make their stainless steel Sauvignon Blanc. So this was made in that stainless steel style, very clean, very crisp. However, the grapes are riper.
Yeah.
And we don't have, I can get real geeky. You want me to
get geeky? Deep dive. Let's get geeky.
So I love it. Like 2 seconds in, we're already talking about this. So Sauvignon Blanc has a lot of what are called pyrazines, which are those aromatic rings that are very reminiscent of capsicum or bell pepper, lemongrass especially. Yep. So in the vineyard in New Zealand, they leave the leaves shading the grapes. And this allows for them to not get, grapes, believe it or not, get sunburn.
Yeah, yep.
So it protects them from sunburn because the ozone layer is thinner there. I told you, geeky.
Geeky.
Geeky. And they have better airflow there and they don't have as much humidity as we do during the ripening season. So they've got shaded grapes and what happens is those pyrazines stay in the grapes. They don't lose it. Whereas here, because we're a cool maritime climate, we're more in line with what they do in Bordeaux, where they have to keep the fruiting zone very clear. I wish people could see my hand gestures.
Yes, so do I.
And talk with my hands.
We're going to do it YouTube at some point. There so we'll go. come back and do another one.
Yeah, the Long Island hands. So here we have to keep the fruit zone clear of leaves. So the Sauvignon Blanc does get a lot more sunlight, which lends it to get more of this. It's very much honeydew, passion fruit, kiwi. There's actually a fruit in New Zealand called Vijoa, which comes out. It's like, it's got the meat has the consistency of pear, but it's a very citrusy flavor.
And it's almost a little, I was going to say pineapple, black currant, like.
A little bit, but it's
but not
grapefruit,
quite.
But it's.
Grapefruit,
it's
yeah.
on the riper end of grapefruit.
Like a pink grapefruit.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah. It's just, it's spectacular.
It's a great breakfast wine. It's 11:30 here.
I had my cup of coffee over at North Fork Roasting because we are on the North Fork of Long Island right now and then came right over here. So this is all my breakfast. Now, you were speaking of the Sauvignon Blanc that, remind me the name,
Migratus.
Migratus. Yeah. Now, that was, we were talking about that earlier. That was the one that had the wild yeast.
So I let it kick off wild. Mm-hmm. I can't totally let go of my biochemistry background, you know. So I let it kick off wild. It gets going on its own, but then before it hits, you know, the top of that bell curve with the yeast population, I'll hit it with more of like a Sancerre style yeast, like something that's gonna even might leave a little bit of residual sugar. It usually doesn't, but it can.
It can.
Uh-huh. So what you get is the benefit of all those different types of yeast, you know, Cleckera, Tolia Sporula, all this stuff that they're playing with now and actually isolating and making commercial yeast out of.
Interesting.
So you get a little bit of flavor of what's coming out of the vineyard, but I don't let it go too funky.
Don't get,
you know,
too
yeah
crazy.
Like it's like I let it kick off natural, do its own thing. It's like a kid, you know, like you let it do its thing and then
to
you
a
come in with
extent.
A little bit of guidelines to keep it on.
Is
the
that
right
a
path.
Cloudy or Sauvignon Blanc, or do you get it clear?
No, we do get it clear. So we, that one does get sterile filtered.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just an like cosmetic thing. It's, you know, now people are a little bit more open to seeing cloudy wines, but as far as doing sales, it's, you know, you right away go from a pretty bottle on the shelf that's easy to buy to a hand sell.
I always tell people when they ask me the difference, I say, you know how we all love organic and we want an organic apple, but you don't want any brown spots?
Right.
You want it to be pretty? This is what you have to think about when you're getting it. It's not always going to be gorgeous.
Yeah. And the other part of that too is when you have a cloudy wine, like if you've had, of course you've had Pet Nats.
Of course. From here.
Yeah. Yep. You know, the lees and what stays behind becomes part of the wine. So if you're not sterile filtering it, that becomes part of the wine. Now, I do a red blend called Harbinger. That's Merlot, Cab Sauv, Petit Verdot. That one, we'll do like, we call it the fly screen. So we'll just do a really light filtration to get any clumps out of there, like any tartrates or anything that have formed in the barrel, just to keep it so, you know, you're not chewing on your wine.
Right.
I don't prefer chewing on wine, unless it's a Pet Nat and I'm in the mood for it.
Right.
And then that one, you know, because there's yeast in there, yeast cells in there that are dead, you know, they have nothing to eat.
Right.
And basically, as those cellular walls break down, they actually bind to the alcohol and they become diglycerides, which gives you that nice, smooth, wet palate feel. So for that, it's great. But for a crisp, white Sauvignon Blanc, maybe don't want that. You know, after you've bottled it.
Well, tell about Saltbird and get yourself up to Saltbird and tell us how much the wines that you have and how you got to what you're doing now.
Yeah, so Saltbird came about because of my dear friend Allie Shaper, who's my partner in Chronicle Wines. 2014, I had come back from New Zealand. I was helping somebody else run their tasting room. hospitality is what I do to sell the wine I make, but I would much prefer to be in a cellar making wine. So in 2014, I was working in a tasting room, and it was like this big piece of me was just missing. I'm watching all this beautiful fruit ripen on the vines around me, talking to my winemaker friends about what an amazing year it was going to be. And it was just, I was probably severely depressed, and Allie picked up on it. It was like, why don't you do one wine, do it under my label, you know, we'll start little, you know, like, and it was like a really small input of money at that time. And I was going to do just my gratis, cause there wasn't a wine out here in that style. And I was like, this is amazing. How it pairs with food. Like, why are we not doing this? Mm-hmm. So it started out with that. And like I said, it was a great vintage. Having worked at Premium, doing all the berry analysis for all the vineyard managers, I knew the vineyard managers, I knew their vineyards, I knew who grew what. And once I put it out there that, like, hey guys, I'm making a wine, I remember Steve Mudd called me and he's like, I got Chardonnay, I got Sauvignon Blanc, I got Merlot, like, what do you want? What do you need?
Oh, what a great neighborhood, like, then.
It is. It's a wonderful community. So that first year I bought Sauvignon Blanc from Macari and Mudd Vineyards. I ended up buying Merlot from Anabay Vineyards and Chardonnay from Steve Mudd because I had no intention of making Chardonnay. Because there's so much of it out here. You know, our main grapes out here are Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc, Merlot, and Cab Franc.
Right.
And then in all their various styles of rosé and sparkling, like, one of the things about Long Island is that we can do a very wide array of wines because we...
Okay, so when you are doing your podcast from an actual tasting room, sometimes we have pauses for our VIP wine club members. We all know and love them. But anyhow, so we're talking about the three AVAs on Long Island, and let's talk a little bit about the difference between South Fork, North Fork, soil, climate. Let's get into that really geeky stuff that I am a soil, I don't know.
No wonder you love Goodell, because Rich Olson Hardwich is the one that wrote the AVA for Long Island. So we are a very Long Island, and anybody who's visited here or lived here realizes that there's a very large difference between Brooklyn and Montauk and all the places in between, both socially, you know, with accents, and also with what are called macroclimates. A microclimate is what's inside of a vine and inside of a cluster of grapes. Macroclimate is that vineyard area. So that AVA would be a macroclimate. So on Long Island, like I said, we're glacial melt. We had two glacial moraines, one formed the South Fork, one formed the North Fork. How much time you got?
I got all the time in the world for this conversation.
So basically what happened is the glaciers came down and they ground up everything in front of them. So that's why the Atlantic Ocean beaches and the Hamptons are that beautiful quartz sand. Mm-hmm. And the same thing on the North Fork on the south side, on the bay side. Whereas it's flipped when you go to the other fork. So the north side of the South Fork is very rocky. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of, you know, bigger boulders and stuff like that. And then on the sound side of the North Fork, again, lots of rocks. You get that silt deposit I was talking about. Yep. And then most of the lakes and ponds out here are, I forget the term for them, but they're actually like where there was glacial melt, and it basically formed a hole all the way down to the water table and there's springs. So like Laurel Lake, Maratuca Lake, they're, I think they call them kettle holes. Like they're formed from the glacial melt.
Okay.
So it's not like we have river. Well, we do have a river, but it's not like upstate where you have rivers running down into a lake. Yep. These were actually formed by like waterfalls coming off the glaciers and forming these ponds and lakes. Like I said, I got hours. So we have three AVAs. Long Island is the main. So it's almost like in Burgundy where you have the concentric rings that get smaller. So you have France, then you have Burgundy, then you have the AVAs within Burgundy. Here we have the USA, we have New York, we have Long Island. And then where it splits within Long Island is we have the North Fork and the South Fork.
Okay. Which was the original, North Fork?
I think it was Long Island, actually.
I think I took some notes on that.
I'll call Rich and find out. I think it was the North Fork, and then the South Fork, I believe, was formed when Wolfer, Duckwalk, and Channing Daughters became like their own little region down there. And they are very different climates. I mean, they're all cool maritime climates. But Wolfer does a Chardonnay that's a late harvest Chardonnay because they have, They have the water currents coming in. So the Gulf Stream. They have the Gulf Stream basically coming in and slamming into Palmcog Bridge. And depending on, you know, what's going on with those ocean currents, it fluctuates anywhere from Long Beach all the way out to Montauk. So it gives them an extended growing season out there. And when you go sailing out here in the fall, you'll see this massive fog bank building up over the south shore.
Yes, fog on the south, right?
That it's, you know, it's something out of a movie when it falls over and creeps over. But we don't necessarily get that. We get fog when there's temperature differences between the air and the soil. They get it because every afternoon in the late summer, early fall, there's fog forming over the water, spilling over into their vineyards and kind of keeping those grapes insulated.
And I don't think people realize, what are we on Long Island, 110 miles long by 15 miles wide?
Something like that,
you know, so it really hits these like microclimates. And we're, that's the whole island. I mean, the two forks are not very
long. No, our growing region is actually, and the weather that we get comes from southern New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've driven down the New Jersey Turnpike,
all the time.
There can be a 20 degree difference between North and South Jersey. So our weather patterns, and I call it the Connecticut slide, the weather patterns will come straight across, they'll hit the Sound, Long Island Sound, and then they literally slide up to Connecticut. So we can be sitting, you know, on the North Shore watching these thunderstorms just not even come, like it goes from a wall to an angle, and that angle hits Connecticut and leaves us alone. So Cutchogue is the sunniest place in New York. And it's because we have these three bodies of water that kind of create their own insulating barrier and kind of push the weather away. Or in the case of hurricanes, it can actually suck it in. So
and wasn't Cutchogue the original winery on Long Island?
Yep, Hargrave, yep.
It's amazing, right? Yeah. How that... So that's the kind of the rundown of the soil.
Yeah.
Now, what are the best grapes that are growing on Long Island, and how is that evolving? Because of climate change, because of soil change, because of preferences? What are you seeing happening?
The biggest change is knowledge base, honestly. You know, we've got more red grapes being planted in Riverhead because we have what Alice Wise calls the banana belt,
which is where
Cornell Cooperative Extension is in Western Riverhead and Calverton, where it's actually a little bit warmer.
Okay.
And I noticed this when I was in the lab at Premium and doing all the berry samples. It would be Merlot would be ripe in Riverhead, and then a couple days later, it'd be ripe in Matatuck, a couple days later in Cutchogue. So it was like this domino effect down the North Fork. So you're starting to see less planting of red grapes towards the end of the North Fork, more white grape being planted towards the end of the North Fork, more reds being planted towards Riverhead. And that's just knowledge.
Okay.
That's just knowing your area. There's also in Riverhead a slight amphitheater. It's, you know, Long Island's not known for our rolling hills, but there is a slight amphitheater effect in Riverhead. You can see it now because a lot of it is sod farms. And you can see where it goes up towards the North Shore. And if you plant red grapes on there with that southern aperture, you're going to get riper grapes. So you can see that at Palmer is the best place to see it. If you sit at Palmer, you know, beautiful place to watch sunset, and you see that it kind of rolls up towards the Sound. And, you know, if you've got the red grapes there facing the right way, you know, that north-south orientation, you're going to get some really beautiful fruit.
What are your favorite grapes to be growing on Long Island? Like, what do you?
I mean, Sauvignon Blanc is a special place in my heart, and I absolutely love Merlot. I love it, and it loves it here.
Yeah,
it is the grape that every vintage, no matter what ridiculous weather we get out here, it's consistently ripe.
And Cab Franc too. I am a Merlot. I have made about 10 years ago. I made a commitment to drink more Merlot and more Cab Franc.
Yeah,
and the Cab Franc's a big grape here.
Yeah,
right?
There's the Cab Franc Forward movement that's happening, which is all across New York State.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And Cab Franc in New York State is really interesting because if you go to like Fjord Vineyards in the Hudson River Valley, it's very perfumey. It's very pretty, which with a name like Cab Franc, you don't think of, but it is actually. It's an older grape. It's the father to Cab Sauv. It's the father to Merlot. It's an older grape. So it's got history. and then out here, you get more like my Ally makes a Cab Franc that's very pomegranate and raspberry. And it has this earthiness across the board. So you can usually tell it's Cab Franc because you got that earthy character. Mm-hmm. And some sort of, you know, it's got a lot of pyrazines in it too. And it usually comes through in Cab Franc as like tomato.
Oh.
Whether it's rose tomato or I am super picky about Cab Franc. It is hysterical because Allie loves it. I'm like, it's got to be really ripe for me to really dig into it. Because if it doesn't ripen, it gets this tomato stem character that I just can't.
It's not your profile.
But no, it does well out here. And again, we go back to that knowledge base thing. Cab Franc was originally planted out here as a blending component for Merlot. So
We're also right next near the train tracks. If anybody's hearing that, that's we're in a little tiny town, a little area, but the train just came by.
Which is why our tasting room is here, because this is limited business Hamlet, because the train stop used to be right across there. Yep. So, yeah, it comes back to that knowledge base. So Cab Franc was planted here as a blending component for Merlot. You know, in the 90s, there were a lot of Merlot Cab Franc blends, which are actually coming back in style again.
Love it.
Yeah. But as it grew, like, Cab Franc grows like a weed here. And you really have to have a vineyard manager that's not afraid to do bud thinning, green harvesting, where you're actually, you know, thinning the shoots.
And that sounds all knowledge-based, too. A lot of trial and error.
Yeah. And, I mean, you're losing your profit. You know, if you have fewer buds, fewer shoots, you know, you try to have only three clusters of grapefruit shoot, which Californians think we're crazy because you're just losing money. But they're not going to fully ripen unless you reduce that fruit load. And it is, you know, if Merlot's growing, you know, an inch a day this time of year, Cab Franc's growing three.
Oh, wow.
So you really have to be on top of it in the vineyard. And like I said, green harvesting can be the, you know, hedge trimming, shoot positioning. Like, you really just have to stay on top of it, because it will just, and it's, these are vines. You know, you think about if you've had bittersweet growing in your garden, what damage it can do, or wisteria.
Yeah, wisteria, right?
You know, this grapevines want to grow into each other and rip your trellising apart. You know, so you really, especially with that grape, have to, you know.
When is harvest here? Is it September, October? Is
it
changing?
It's getting earlier and earlier every year. So that does come to climate change. We've already hit bud break here, which is.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah, we hit it last week in Baconic here. As you can see, our urban vineyard, we've got grapevines growing on the sidewalk in front of our shop. Yeah, those all just kind of popped out in the last 5 days. And, you know, 2003, when I first got into the industry, bud break was towards Mother's Day, like mid-May. This is crazy. And this isn't an anomaly anymore. This is a norm.
Right. So change and a lot of change.
Yeah.
And also, so we were just talking about Cab Franc as a blending grape. And one of the discussions we have is blends versus single varietals. And I think we were joking that, you know, here in the U.S., people like to think that they like a single varietal, but they really like blends, right? What are you seeing in terms of, on Long Island in particular, in terms of, are we going more towards single varietals? Are people still blending here? What are you doing on your own?
Both. Okay. I mean, one of the things I hate about the wine industry is how pretentious it can be. And I think now, with everybody being a little bit more inclusive on all things, you need to make wine more approachable, not less approachable.
That's the whole point of this podcast, making wine more approachable. That's actually what our podcast is
right.
about.
Right, and I came into this through the science end, so I didn't know the wine part of it. You know, I didn't know the difference between Bordeaux, Burgundy, Premier Cru, and Premier, had no idea what any of this was. So I actually got certified through WSET, so I knew, especially when I was running the wine lab, and I'm talking to Gilles Martin and, you know, Roman Roth and Russell Hearn, these guys are all, you know, incredibly knowledgeable people, and I'm telling them about flaws in a barrel of wine, having no idea what the greater wine world is. You know, when I first learned about Brett, I was so confused, because I'm like, wait, this is a wine flaw, but some people like it.
It's good. I don't understand.
But it can be good, a little bit. So I'm like, you know, and then once I started, I came from it from the science background. So once I trained myself to recognize, you know, volatile acidity, Brett, you know, mouse taint. Like, once I smell those in a wine, I'm like, nope, tainted, bad. And I remember doing orange wine tastings when orange wines were first being made out here. They were interesting, you know, and it was like you had to kind of hang up that wine fault hat and be like, okay, let me get through this and then see what else this wine has to, you know, give
me. It's always challenging with
that. It's a fine balance, and that's, you know, where I struggle with natural wines, because I've had some amazing natural wines and I've had some not great natural wines.
I completely agree. That we're going to have a whole episode on that, because I agree with you on
that. How do you create consistency? And like, I am not a multimillionaire that does this as a hobby. Like, this is my job. This is what I've invested in. Like, I have to sell my wine.
Right.
I can't have, like, a flawed wine that I put in the universe and hope people, you know, like it.
Well,
you know,
if you could play with anything, if you did have unlimited, what kind of wine or varietal would you grow here?
Yeah. Oh, I'd probably start playing a lot more with, like, Albarino.
Right?
I have to say, like, the hybrids that are coming out right now are pretty stunning. There's a couple of Sauvignon Blanc hybrids that I've been making experimental wine for Cornell Cooperative with that I'm pretty impressed with.
Yeah, yeah. Something different
so,
there.
You know, we're this knowledge base, like we're coming to a point where, you know, we know what works, what doesn't work. You know, hybrids 20 years ago are not what they are now. But the thing with vineyards is it takes 7 years to get that vine mature to really see what it's doing. And, you know, with grapevines, they're all grafts. So you can't take a Sauvignon Blanc seed and plant it in your garden and be like, that's a Sauvignon Blanc vine. Because in the viticultural world, that's now a new variety.
Isn't that interesting, right?
Yeah. So, you know, it takes decades to develop a hybrid. And we're kind of getting that point in the U.S. where we're actually discovering like some pretty great hybrids. So I'd probably plant a vineyard just of hybrids.
And see where it goes.
Just see where it goes. And, you know, Merlot, you know, Lagrange does great out here. You know, some of the Northern Italian red varietals, I'd probably play with that.
Yeah.
But that's because I'd have all the money in the world and could
all
just
the
like,
money in the
not
world,
care.
Right?
Yeah. And it's like, oh, you know, we're 7 years into this project and we really don't like this grape. Oh, well.
Okay. I love the Albarino. I really love tasting the Albarinos here. Our friend Kim McPherson out of Texas does an Albarino. Then you taste the Albarinos coming from Europe. I mean, something about an Albarino. My mouth's just watering thinking about it, right?
I wish I could get my hands on it because the way my winery model works is I buy from other... Mm-hmm. So I'm a negociant. So I basically buy grapes, ferment them in the wine. So the wine industry is three very separate businesses that are expected to function as one. And I always use the example of Campbell's soup.
Oh,
like,
okay.
Do you expect Campbell's soup to grow their own tomatoes, make their own soup, and then that same guy that grew the tomatoes is now going to go sell that can of soup?
Yeah.
Like, it's unheard of. But in the wine industry, because of the traditional European models, we do all of it. And that's what makes it, you know, a more, you know, like, you know, you talk about soil to table or farm to table. Like, we've always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
And hospitality has always been a big part of it. So, you know, it's interesting that that's what's kind of expected of us. But I would rather leave, especially out here in a growing region that is very difficult and you need to know what you're doing. Like, we're right on the edge of what can be done out here, which is also what makes it really interesting.
Exciting, yes.
But I'd rather have, you know, a Sam McCullough who's been doing this for 40 years, who really knows what he's doing, growing the grapes. Or, you know, John Leo or these guys who have been doing this for decades, they know what they're doing.
Right.
And I'd rather let them do their thing.
And then you do your magic on the other end.
And then if I could find somebody to sell it for me so I could just like hang out in my cellar, I would be just happy as a duck.
Well, that's a great segue into that. What do you want people to know? Well, what's the most challenging thing to you? So is it the selling of it? Is it the perception of Long Island wines?
I think the perception of Long Island wines is, I mean, we're 51 years old now. We
Isn't
did
that
the
amazing?
50, and I was on the Long Island Wine Country Board organizing that 50th celebration. We're here. Like, the wines are good quality. It's not like you go to any, like, back in the day.
I remember tasting in the 90s, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah, you needed to know where to go.
Yeah.
It's not like that anymore. Yeah. There's a wine, now it's about finding your preference. So if you like a sweet wine, go to this place. If you like Gruner Veltliner, go to One Woman. You know, if you want really
Who's doing Gruner on Long Island?
One Woman, Claudia.
Oh, it's literally called One Woman.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I thought you were like giving it a, I'm going to have to, because, you know, Gruner.
Oh, you're gonna have to go over there.
My wine club loves a Gruner. My wine club is acid Austrian wines. They love a Gruner. We bring it in for wine club. So I'm really happy to hear that's on
all
Long
right,
Island.
So I'm going to give you directions so you can go over there after this. You know, you want a rich Cab Franc, go to, you know, Roanoke Vineyards because they're in that banana belt that I was talking about and they're doing some great reds. So it's more about finding your personality too.
I
mean, we're like a cozy little, it's like you're in our wine living room when you're here, or you want to go to Sparkling Point and have caviar and sit
so
in their
exciting.
Bubble room, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really about just what you want as far as the place and the people and the type of wine. So, you know, the Long Island Wine Country Board we're actually working on now, like with the website, being able to go in there and basically be like, you know, I want these parameters for my visit. And it'll be like, and here's your winery.
Oh, I love that.
You know?
I love that. That's a big change even from a handful of
years
ago, I feel
When I first got in the industry, my grandmother and her sister are British. And I remember telling my great aunt that I was going into the wine industry. She was so disappointed. She would not drink the wines I made, like when I was, wouldn't drink them. And then I remember going up there for, you know, dinner, which was actually, you know, middle of the day lunch, and just putting it in a decanter and putting it in the middle of the table. she had it, and she's like, this is wonderful. What is this? This is, oh, is this Bordeaux? Like, what? And I was like, it's Long Island Merlot.
It's Long Island
and
Merlot.
And she was like, oh, this really is a thing. And it was like, yeah, but that, again, that was 25 years ago. Like, we've come a very, or not 25, it was 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, we've come a very long way. And I think, you know, people like myself going across seas, you know, having, you know, Gilles, who's trained in Bordeaux, coming over here in Champagne, like, we've had people that have recognized that there's something here, coming from other wine regions and investing in this area and, you know, picking up their lives and moving here to make wine. And now we've got my generation, you know, Karim Massoud, like, we've gone and traveled abroad, brought that knowledge base back. Like, with my Sauvignon Blanc, I'm not trying to make a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. I'm using techniques I learned in New Zealand to make a Long Island Sauvignon Blanc.
I love that. That's a great way to say it.
Yeah. Like, we're in Long Island. Like, right. What are we doing trying to make it from other places, you know? So,
and give it a sense of, you know, so we have a scent memory, a taste memory of having this Long Island one, which is definitely going to sit with me. I mean, as an incredible winemaker, how do you feel about, in general, being a woman winemaker in Long Island within the industry? I mean, you obviously have had all the support, which is just wonderful. do you find it to be a little challenging, though? I mean, you have Long Island, you're a woman winemaker.
I did when I was ready to make that jump from running a lab to winemaker. I could not, you know, like, I ended up doing my own thing because I was not getting hired as a winemaker or cellar hand. I remember going to one winery that I knew didn't have a winemaker at the time. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm free if you need somebody, you know, to come work for you. And they're like, oh, yeah, we're opening up another tasting room. You can run the tasting room. I was like,
that's not what?
Like, I have zero hospitality background. Like, why would you put me in a tasting room? And then I did end up working in tasting rooms. And I'm glad I did because I saw what people wanted. So when it came time to make my own brand, which is how I made that leap, was just doing it myself. And I was blessed to have, you know, the support of my friend and, you know, the, you know, my husband being like, I guess so.
Sure.
You're going to keep your day job, right? Yeah. All right. Yeah. So that was hard. Because I just wasn't seeing. I'm also, you know, like, you guys don't have a visual, but I'm only 5'2". At the time, I was like 120 pounds. Like, I did not fit the stereotype of a winemaker cellar hand. And it is, you know, even now in the cellar, I have a production winemaker that thankfully is 6'2" and very muscular, and he can get the heavy thing off the top shelf. And he jokes all the time about, like, he's like, wow, the world really is made for a 6-foot-tall man. I'm like, yes,
it
like, yes,
yes, it is.
You know, I make it work. I mean, I probably put on like 10 pounds of muscle during harvest, which all goes away as soon as it's over because you're so tired. Yeah. But, yeah, so in that part it was, but like once you can talk the talk, there's no difference. You know,
I love that.
There really isn't. And my Allie and I at Chronicle have been very supportive of trying to bring women in. My very dear friend Alyssa Goodale is over at Borghese, and she's their vineyard manager.
You just passed that. I don't think I've ever tasted
that. Was Hargrave.
Ah.
Borghese bought Hargrave. Gotcha. So. There's more and more, and Marin at Bedell, like, there's more and more women moving into these lead roles, and there, I don't know. I mean, I get it when I get on the, I get it when I do sales. When I go on the road and do sales, people are constantly, and Allie will tell you the same thing, but who's actually making your wine? And it's like,
And you can't believe you're still hearing that question.
Really? Like, okay. And it's also like the perception of what happens in the winery. I mean, everybody kind of has a perception of this one guy, this one big dude walking around the winery, like lifting barrels and tasting wine. But the reality is the winemaker is usually not the one racking and cleaning tanks and doing this stuff. So, and I've done all of that. Like, I've worked up all through that. And I remember, like, when I started a consulting job I have now, like, they did not expect me to get into the tank and sanitize it. I was like, this is what needs to be done in this moment to get this wine in and keep the quality up. And they're like, oh, and I know how to drive a forklift.
And it, that is a talent, actually.
Yeah. And it's, you know, you, by the end of harvest, you've become one with the forklift. And like, it is always funny watching somebody get on it for the first time because they're not used to that rear wheel drive is the biggest thing to get over. But yeah, so people see me on the forklift and they're like, oh, wow, badass girl in a forklift. And it's like, no, this is a skill set that you get a license for. Like, you take it down, you know, like, anybody can do it.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm really pleased to hear that. I was expecting to hear, it was a little bit more difficult. And do you think part of it is the community here on Long Island because it's tighter knit? Or are you just, you feeling like this is just the trend that you're seeing, that more open and welcoming to winemakers, women, doesn't matter?
I mean, I think it also has to do with how resumes circulate. Because I had a job in Tasmania, And because my name is Robin and it's the male spelling with an I, I got on the phone with the assistant winemaker at Bay of Fires Winery, and this guy, Robbo, and he's like, hi, I'm trying to get a hold of Robin. I'm like, yep, this is her. And he's like, oh, you're a girl.
Oh, good Lord.
I was like, yeah, is that going to be a problem? He's like, no. I just expected you to be a guy because of your resume and, you know, the way your name is spelled. And I was like, really? Okay, yeah, all right. Sure. Yeah, so, you know, so I definitely, the way he reacted, I don't know if that resume would have hit that next level if he'd known that I was a tiny little petite female.
Well, I love that you are where you are. I've loved talking. I've got a couple of quick, easy questions to end this fabulous podcast. I'm so excited to
I know. I feel like we've talked about everything and nothing.
All the geeky stuff. We got geeky, and I love it. All right, so this is going to be an easy one. What is, because we are on Long Island, what is your favorite summer beach wine? We're talking a beautiful day on the beach. You're at maybe Field 5, which is, you know, my old hunting grounds over there, Robert Moses. You snuck in that bottle of wine that you know, never supposed to have on the beach.
Well, what out here, drinking? It's, you know, out here, you know, those secret spots where you're the only one.
Yeah, on even beach. Better, right?
So that's where you bring a full picnic spread. I would say my ideal beach day is probably going to be like a cooler full of ice cold oysters, which is like a lemon sliced up and like a stainless steel Sauvignon Blanc or an Albarino. I mean, Pominac is making a beautiful Albarino right now that I would love to be able to get my hands on that fruit. But they sell it all, so they don't need to sell it.
Well, you know, maybe something in the future. And all right, so as we've been discussing through our podcast, one of our favorite people and Renee's favorite people is Alicia Moore, a.k.a. Pink.
I didn't actually know her.
Yes, she is. Two Wolves, which is an incredible winery.
Really?
And Renee has just become a member of the tribe and has ordered in her 3-pack of wines. So
I need to try this because I remember watching her documentary when she was on the road with her two young kids.
Yes, which is a fabulous documentary.
My daughter was, I think, around the same age as her son. And I just remember her with this like giant glass of red wine after the show. And I was like,
her wine is
love that.
Spectacular. It is very difficult to get into. Renee had to wait 2 years to become part of the list. So we are asking you the last question of the day before we toast and end our podcast. What is your favorite Pink song?
Well, it's the one that goes da 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 da. I just lost my husband. I don't know where he went. And that is a song that, like, there are some days during harvest where I'll literally just like walk in and turn that on because it's so what? I'm still a rock star, you know. And it was like, yep. So what? We're just gonna go. We're gonna do the thing, and we're gonna blast Pink in the middle of the cellar.
I love it. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you for spending the morning with me.
Thank you for making the drive out here.
You are welcome.